You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is one of the most knowledgeable people in America on the dangers of plastic to human health. Her name is Judith Enke. She's a former regional director at the EPA under the Obama administration and the president of Beyond Plastics. She's also the author of a new book, The Problem with Plastic: How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. Welcome to the exchange, Judith.
Thanks, Mike. I'm delighted to be with you and your listeners.
Well, I think the best way to start this conversation is by you reading a couple of paragraphs from your powerful introduction.
Oh, I'd be happy to. So the introduction to the book, The Problem with Plastic, by Judith Enke and Adam Mahoney, reads as follows. Plastic is everywhere, wrapped around our food, stitched into our clothes, even coursing through our veins. What began as a marvel of modern science has been woven so tightly into the fabric of our lives that imagining a world without it seems impossible. Plastic has fueled groundbreaking innovations from artificial joints to renewable energy technology. Yet its legacy is one of poisoned oceans, polluted air, and ecosystems choked by waste. In just 75 years, plastic has cradled our planet in a synthetic embrace. Take a look around you. Are you outside reading in a park, at your local bookstore, in your favorite cafe? Wherever you are, the remnants of the life cycle of plastic are ubiquitous. From the moment you wake to brush your teeth to the time you drift to sleep under your polyester sheets, plastic is there. And not just because it's in your bloodstream. We have constructed a world on the promise of convenience, but that foundation is crumbling, and the consequences are leaching into every element of our lives. The question we now face is whether we can break free from this dependence before it breaks us.
Wow, Judith. You say plastic is everywhere, but what is plastic?
Well, it is a synthetic material that is made from 16,000 different chemicals and from fossil fuels. It's different colors. There are so many different types of plastic, and they all have different chemical combinations. They last forever. Plastic is not degradable. It does break up in the environment into little pieces of plastic, but it never breaks down.
So you said it's 16,000 chemicals?
Yes. Plastics used to be made from fewer chemicals in oil. Now it's made from 16,000 different chemicals, including PFAS chemicals, the forever chemicals, lead, mercury, cadmium, formaldehyde, 16,000 in total, and many times in different combinations. And then the reason, Mike, that we are seeing so much more plastic in our lives and in our environment is not because any of us voted for more plastic, but because plastic is now made instead of from oil and chemicals, it's made from chemicals and ethane, which is a waste product from hydrofracking. Because there is a glut of fracked gas on the market, the plastics industry is using that byproduct from fracking to make new plastic.
Your book has a dire warning in the title. What does too late mean?
I think too late means even worse health outcomes from having plastics in your body. We can talk about what we know now about plastics in our body. Too late means turning our ocean into a watery landfill that it can't really recover from in terms of marine impacts. Too late also means contributing to the climate crisis. Plastics is a climate change issue because it is made from fossil fuels and chemicals. And we know that the climate change problem is getting worse with every passing year. And even if you could somehow, turn the ship around immediately, it's important for listeners to understand that greenhouse gas emissions that are released into the atmosphere today often last for decades. So you can't just flip the switch. If you want to get more serious about climate change, which I hope every elected official and resident of our world will get more serious about climate change, we've got to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And that also means making less plastic.
Well, that's an interesting point, because you mentioned fracking, you mentioned ethane, you mentioned all the various different chemicals that are in use by a variety of different industries. And you also wrote this, quote, "By design, low-income people and communities of color bear the burden of plastics. The destructive web of plastics gathers in their neighborhoods, rivers, air, and bodies," end quote. What do you mean by design?
Well, what I mean is the history of the United States polluting facilities, for instance, plastic production facilities, which release a lot of pollution, are typically located in low-income communities and communities of color, known as environmental justice communities. And that is very pronounced in Louisiana, Texas, and Appalachia. That's where most plastic is produced. You don't see big polluting plastic production facilities in Beverly Hills or suburban Portland or Scarsdale, New York. You see these facilities purposefully being located in low-income communities and communities of color. For example, there's a stretch of the Mississippi River in Louisiana called Cancer Alley. It's about 85 miles between New Orleans and Baton Rouge. And whenever anyone is in New Orleans, you should take an extra day and just literally drive north up the Mississippi River. And I think most people would be very surprised to see this concentration of petrochemical facilities belching air pollution into the air, releasing toxic chemicals into the river. And then when the air pollution comes down and lands on our soil, contaminating soil. That part of the Mississippi River called Cancer Alley experiences 7 times higher the national average for cancer than other communities in the United States. And that's according to a recent study from Johns Hopkins. So there is this concentration of petrochemical facilities, and those residents are getting sick from living near these facilities. And unfortunately, the governments in Louisiana and Texas and West Virginia and Ohio and Pennsylvania are not protecting their residents from these health impacts. And at the federal level, it's even worse, because the Trump administration has decided that the Environmental Protection Agency, where I used to work, is no longer going to be involved in seriously protecting public health and the environment. In fact, just a few days ago, they announced a new policy that when they're looking at how to regulate air pollution, they will no longer calculate health damage. They're just going to look at the cost to business if you require stricter controls on air pollution. I mean, this is unprecedented. The Federal Clean Air Act requires regulators to look at health impacts, but with the stroke of a pen, not a law, the Trump administration says they are no longer going to consider health impacts from air pollution. So our sisters and brothers living in these environmental justice communities are suffering. And what we all can do, if we don't live there, is work on comprehensive policies to reduce the use of plastic so much does not have to be manufactured there.
My guest is Judith Enck, author of The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. Judith, since plastics exist by design, and you just talked about Cancer Alley, which is a zoning area by design, who are the architects and designers? Do they have names and faces?
Yes, familiar names. ExxonMobil, Shell, Dow, DuPont. What's really interesting is for years, fossil fuel companies made their money by selling fossil fuels for transportation and electricity generation, two very important things. But if you look what's happening in the economy on transportation, there is a slow shift toward electric vehicles and electric trucks and ships and buses. So over time, there'll be less demand for fossil fuel for transportation. And then at the same time, we see a reduced demand for fossil fuel for electricity generation because we're finally and slowly seeing a shift to clean renewable energy sources like solar, wind, geothermal, small-scale hydropower. And let's never forget energy conservation or efficiency, which is the best strategy and the best thing to reduce our utility bills. So companies like ExxonMobil saw this shift happening, and they decided that they were going to make big investments in plastic pollution. They don't call it plastic pollution, just plastics. And that is their new growth market. And in fact, ExxonMobil is the largest plastic producer in the country.
Wow, that's astounding. So here in Oregon, we tend to prioritize taking care of the environment. So the environment will take care of us. In your research for your book, what'd you find here?
Well, one really good law that Oregon has had on the books for decades is the returnable beverage container law, known as bottle bills. Oregon did it first. It was championed by a state legislator at the time, a young guy named Jeff Merkley, who is now your U.S. senator, and who is a real champion on environmental issues in the U.S. Senate. But I really appreciate Oregon going first and then being followed by 9 other states to adopt returnable beverage containers. You get a refundable deposit, as I'm sure all your listeners know. We certainly would like to see more refillable containers, not just recyclable. Oregon has also recently passed a law designed to reduce packaging. It's called Extender Producer Responsibility, or EPR. And it's really important that the public get actively involved in giving their views and their ideas to the Oregon State Agency to make sure that this law is properly implemented. Because rest assured, packaging companies like Amazon and McDonald's and Kraft Food are always at the table trying to weaken policies. So we need to see a whole lot more public participation, public hearings, public engagement to make this law be truly effective.
Well, we're nearing a break, but before we get there, you write about the emergence of suspicion about the dangers of plastics in the 1960s. It was even mentioned in a 1967 film with Dustin Hoffman.
Yes. In The Graduate, an older gentleman turns to Dustin Hoffman and says, "The future is plastic." And I've actually been trying to find Dustin Hoffman's agent to convince them to film a little public service announcement that says, "The future is not plastic, it's in refillable, reusable, and waste reduction." But for some reason, Dustin Hoffman's agent is not calling me back. But that's a little side project I've got going on, because wouldn't it be nice if we could recast that?
That would be fun.
Yeah, these are just little things I do to amuse myself while I read study after study about the health impacts of plastics. It would be nice to have some high profile entertainment people get in the mix with us. We're actually doing a fundraiser online next month with Cynthia Nixon, who is a well-known actress, stage and screen. And she's jumping in and helping us ring the bell on the plastic pollution problem.
Well, it sounds like you're recruiting a coalition. But we need to take a short break. We'll be right back with my guest, Judith Enck, author of The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange on JPR. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Judith Enck. She's the president of Beyond Plastics and author of a new book, The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. Judith, you write about the 1980s as a decade of deceit. Tell me about that.
Well, those of us that remember the 1980s, if we were around, you turned on TV and you saw TV commercials sponsored by an outfit called Keep America Beautiful. And they did this iconic commercial with an Italian actor dressed up as an American Indian with a tear coming down his cheek saying something like, "People produce litter." I don't even remember the tagline because I'm so annoyed by it. And it was designed to shift the responsibility for cleaning up the environment away from corporate polluters and toward you and me as individuals.
I remember that.
And they coined the phrase litter bugs. And I agree, no one should litter. It's not a good thing. And it's against the law in many communities. But even if you don't litter, we as a society have a major pollution problem. And so this notion that it's just up to you and me and we shouldn't litter and everything will be fine was really deceptive and misleading.
You also wrote that in 1950, the world produced just 2 million tons of plastic. It now produces more than 450 million tons per year. How?
Yeah, that's a staggering statistic. It's because consumer brand companies think that plastic is cheaper than, say, paper, metal, glass. But it's not really cheaper when you look at the environmental impacts and the health impacts. So you have the combination of a massive advertising campaign where plastic producers deceived the public, trying to make us think that most plastics are recyclable when in fact most are not. And then you had big consumer brand companies choosing plastic over other materials because of their bottom line. And also we've become a throwaway society. Things that used to last and you could use over and over again are often now single use. We're consuming more than ever before. And, you know, you look at the average American supermarket, it's a lot bigger and it's a lot more complicated than it was even just a few years ago. And with that, you get more and more single-use plastic. About 40% of plastic is used for single-use plastic packaging. And I do want to say that there are some necessary uses of plastic. For instance, wind turbines contain plastic parts. Cars might have a plastic bumper, which makes it lighter and more fuel efficient. But I've never walked down the street or gone to a park and seen part of a wind turbine or part of a car bumper at the park. We're really focused on what I refer to as pointless plastic. You go to a hospital, you go to a supermarket, you go to a restaurant, you're going to see a lot of pointless plastic. And the big concern is the pointless plastic that is directly touching our food and our beverages.
Well, recycling is a big industry here in Oregon. How does recycling plastic fit into the solutions formula, or does it?
It doesn't. So everyone should keep recycling their paper, cardboard, metal, glass, compost your yard waste and your food waste. But we need to have a reckoning when it comes to plastic recycling. The plastic recycling rate in the United States is between 5 and 6%. And what mostly gets recycled is soda bottles, like from Oregon's bottle bill, milk jugs, things like that. I want listeners to understand why plastic recycling has never worked and never will work. If you have an old aluminum can, you know, an empty Coke can, you can recycle that into a new aluminum can. If you have an old newspaper, you can recycle that into another paper product. It doesn't work that way for plastics because, as I mentioned, there are 16,000 different chemicals, many different types of plastics known as polymers, and many different colors. So if you think of your own home or apartment, Mike, you might have a bright orange hard plastic detergent bottle near your washing machine, and then you might have a black plastic takeout container in your refrigerator and a clear plastic film bag that your bread comes in. Those three plastics cannot be recycled together. Different color, different polymer type, and different chemical combination. So if plastics recycling were to work, you would need hundreds or thousands of different sorts, and that's just not economical or practical or real. So that's why the plastic recycling rate has always been so low. And the people who know this the most are the companies that make plastic. This is not surprising to them, yet they spend millions of dollars trying to convince you and me that we don't have to worry about all the plastics in our lives. We can just toss it in the recycling bin. The situation is so serious that the California Attorney General, Rob Bonta, sued ExxonMobil in September of 2024 for deceptive claims about plastics recycling. And the court system is slow, but I'm pretty sure that the California Attorney General is going to win that case in the end, and we can finally get the plastic companies to stop deceiving the public about plastics recycling.
So, okay, so hopefully that happens. I don't know what the time frame is going to be. As you said, the courts are very slow, and think the federal administration now is making them even slower. But you revealed data on greenhouse gas emissions from plastics in the United States. And in that data, fracking, along with exports and imports, are having a huge impact. What's happening there?
Yeah, so, you know, fracking releases greenhouse gases into the environment, and then moving all the plastics around releases greenhouse gases. So we wanted to figure out just how much greenhouse gas emissions resulted from production, use, and disposal of plastics. And so in October of 2022, we did a report, and it's on our website, beyondplastics.org, plural, beyondplastics.org. You can see our report called The New Coal, Plastics and Climate Change. And we found that roughly 232 million tons of greenhouse gases were emitted into the atmosphere every year from plastics. That's the equivalent to about 116 coal-fired power plants. So while the environmental community is working hard, along with doctors and nurses, to shut down polluting coal-fired power plants, we are replacing those greenhouse gas emissions from plastic production, use, and disposal.
My guest is Judith Enck, author of The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. Judith, you write that ocean plastic is a growing problem, but how can that be a problem when it's floating way out in the middle of the ocean?
Well, it doesn't flow way out and stay on the surface. So what happens is plastic from the land gets into the ocean. So it could be walking on a city street and you lose a plastic water bottle or a plastic bag. It gets into a storm sewer. The river, the stream eventually gets into the ocean. What happens is when it's on the surface of the ocean, because it's exposed to sunlight, the plastic gets brittle. The wave action acts like a paper cutter, so one plastic water bottle can become hundreds of different pieces of plastic. Most of the plastic falls to the sea floor. It falls to the bottom. It doesn't hang out that long on the surface. And then it is eaten by fish and seabirds and sea turtles, and it builds up in the marine environment. Remember, about 71% of the Earth's surface is covered by the ocean, and we've got 33 billion pounds of plastic entering the ocean every year. That's the equivalent of two garbage trucks of plastic every minute. So we really are turning the ocean into a landfill with profound impacts on the marine environment. And also for people who eat fish from the ocean, it's a major protein source. And particularly if you eat fish and you eat the stomach, you are getting quite the dose of microplastics.
So then the plastics go from the marine animals into us.
Yep. Unfortunately.
You address the problem of false solutions versus real solutions. Tell me about both.
Well, the real solution is quite simple, but politically difficult. Making less plastic is the solution. And there are alternatives to plastic: reusable, refillable packaging. I mentioned paper, cardboard, glass, metal. Those are not space age breakthroughs. Those are affordable alternatives to plastic. Instead, the plastic industry continues to deceive the public about plastics recycling, and now they're pushing something called chemical recycling, which is heating plastic to a high temperature and turning it into fossil fuel. It has not worked for decades. It's expensive. We took a close look at this 2 years ago because this is what the chemical companies say is the solution. We found that there were only 11 facilities in the whole country using chemical recycling. And since our report, 3 of the 11 have shut down. And at the time, the 11 were handling just over 1% of plastic waste in the nation. So chemical recycling is more of a press release or a talking point for an industry lobbyist. It's not really going to work to solve the problem.
So what is best case scenario, let's say by 2050, if we got serious as a nation towards solving this problem?
Well, we want to build a reuse refill infrastructure. Let's return to refillable glass bottles, which create local jobs. We want to make sure that we're shifting away from plastic. You know, we can still buy everything we buy today. It just doesn't have to be packaged in plastic. And then we also have to be very honest about the health impacts of plastic and work to protect people's health. And, you know, I think the challenge here is it's not one thing. It's many, many different doable things. Make sure your kids' cafeteria or your grandkids' cafeteria uses real dishes in the cafeteria. They're going to have to buy dishes and probably dishwashing equipment, but that's better for our children not to be eating off of single-use plastics. When you go to the airport, you can often fill your water bottle at a water refill station. How about installing those water refill stations at train stations and bus stations and all our public parks? Meals on Wheels programs, which are so important. They're volunteers delivering hot meals to seniors and people with disabilities. You've got a built-in return system. So drop off the meals in reusable packaging. So when the volunteer drops off the hot meal, they can take the previous used plates and dishes back and just wash them in a dishwashing equipment. I hear occasionally from wineries, they're spending 80 cents per glass bottle for wine. They would like to use refillable wine bottles, but they need support in building commercial bottle washing operations. We lived a full life decades ago, not being buried in plastic. So it's really a return to basics and also making sure that the companies that produce all this plastic have skin in the game. You know, we get so much plastic when we buy things, and then the companies that are selling it to us have no financial responsibility to take care of all that plastic. That's why the extended producer responsibility law is so important, because we need companies to be designing not only products, but packaging differently. They need to help us fix the problem. They don't do it voluntarily, which is why we need new laws to require this.
Okay, so we need a back-to-basic approach. Well, unfortunately, we only have about 30 seconds left, and I did want to ask you about Adam Mahoney, who contributed to your book. Tell me about your partnership.
Yes, thank you. Adam Mahoney is a very talented young journalist based in New Orleans, and he wrote the book with me. He is very focused in his reporting on environmental justice issues. And so when you read the book, The Problem with Plastic, you'll see there's not just a chapter on environmental justice, but it is fully integrated into every part of the book. And it was a real honor and pleasure to work with Adam Mahoney. He's a up-and-coming young journalist. Keep your eye on him.
Well, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. I do have to say this is a must-read book. And thank you, Judith. And thank you, Adam, for writing it.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks for having us. The book's available everywhere. Sales are going well. All proceeds go to Beyond Plastics.
My guest was Judith Enke, author of The Problem with Plastic, How We Can Save Ourselves and Our Planet Before It's Too Late. I'm Mike Green. You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio.